Welcome. This is the second in a series of lectures concerned with the clinical process as it unfolds between patient and clinician. In the first lecture of the series, we outlined this clinical process in terms of five basic steps: gathering data, analyzing findings, making a diagnosis, choosing a treatment, and communicating the plan. In this lecture, we will focus on the process of gathering data. Consider the story depicted on this slide, the case of a man who came to the clinic because of ankle swelling. The story goes like this. The clinic assistant says, "Blood pressure 225 over 140, as she brings in a man whose shoes are untied and loosened, with ankles bulging over the top. He looks healthy enough, but is a little pale. He says he's short of breath after walking in from the parking lot, but his lungs sound clear and he's only breathing 12 times a minute. Do you smoke?" you say. "Used to. I quit 3 years ago." He says he's been gaining weight lately, and his clothes are fitting tight. You check his heart, which has an S4 gallop, but no murmur. You ask about his clothes. First his shoes, later his pants felt too tight. You check his abdomen, which shows no tenderness, masses, or enlarged organs. Then he recalls that he was on medication for blood pressure a few years back, but stopped taking it because he felt slowed down. You check his pulse. It's 120, and notice 2+ pitting to the mid-shin. "Ever been sick before?" you ask. "No, never in all my 39 years, except once when I got a rash from aspirin. Oh yeah, and to have my tonsils out." As we try to understand the clinical process of taking care of patients such as this man with leg swelling, one danger in modeling the process is that creating the model can introduce, often inadvertently, attributes that are not part of the process itself. These may be artifacts of the model. The clinical process is often described, or initially learned, as depicted on this slide. Beginning with the taking of a history, followed by performance of a physical examination. Then follows a step in which all the data are gathered together to form an assessment based on this information before creating a plan. This so-called complete history and physical would appear to be a discrete, linear, orderly, and structured process. And indeed, it can be performed this way. However, observations of clinicians in real life suggest that the process often does not follow this rigid pattern at all. Studies by Arthur Elstein and others elucidated that clinicians generally employ an iterative, hypothetico-deductive reasoning process. In this process, the experience reported by the patient, which we call symptoms, and the observations made by the clinician, which we call signs, are being gathered simultaneously, not one after the other. Furthermore, making sense of this information, assessing it, formulating hypotheses about it, begins not after gathering all the data, but within a very short period of time after the initial process begins, as little as 20 or 30 seconds. Symptoms and signs are uncovered. Some set of working candidate diagnoses are considered. These hypotheses are then tested with further questioning, which can eliminate some or corroborate others. The process proceeds in an iterative hypothesis testing cycle until sufficient certainty has been reached for action. Elstein et al. Described some of the cognitive properties of this process, such as narrowing of the cognitive space of possibilities. But for our purposes, suffice it to say that an iterative, cyclical process of information gathering and assessment takes place, which does not follow the typical linear, orderly, discrete sequence present earlier. This may have implications for information systems if we inadvertently enforce the wrong model of the process in our information tools. As was mentioned earlier, the process is a combination of open-ended questions and closed-ended questions. Initially, clinicians try to get the story using an open-ended question that enables a person to tell the story in their own words. One may alternately include or exclude family members and others depending on the patient's ability, the sensitive nature of the information, and other factors. Once this initial story has taken shape, the clinician may then proceed with more closed-ended questions, either to pursue specific hypotheses or to employ a comprehensive scanning approach to make sure that all bases have been covered. This latter is referred to as a review of systems in clinical documents. It is important to understand the tools used to gather and record and analyze this information may affect the process, and that collection of this information is different from documentation of it. Once the data has been gathered, it needs to be given some structure. In medical practice, physicians use a highly structured arrangement that has been used for generations, called the history and physical. As David Sackett has said, every medical student should learn to do a complete history and physical, and then never do one. I think what he means by this is that learning a comprehensive history and physical, and enforcing it in memory, provides a cognitive structure which students can use to give organization and meaning to what otherwise might be very difficult to comprehend data. Through repetition and practice, this structure becomes second nature and provides an efficient scaffolding both for thinking and for communication. However, once the novice has acquired sufficient expertise, it becomes necessary to tailor and individualize the process to the patient and the context. As has been said, the novice knows the rules, the expert knows the exceptions. This slide shows a very brief overview of the highly structured data organization which has been used by physicians for generations. Most any textbook of clinical skills will contain an example of this arrangement. It begins with data that identifies the patient and also the source of the information, which may be the patient or a family member or old records or some other source. This is followed with the so-called chief complaint. A more modern name for this might be reason for admission. Clinicians are encouraged to use the patient's own words when recording the chief complaint. Following this is a section called the present illness. This is usually a narrative, chronologically ordered, paragraph or more, containing the details of the patient's current problem as related to the clinician. Following this is a summary of the patient's past history, which has a substructure that includes specific information about allergies, current medications and treatments, past medical problems, past surgical history, and for women, their prior menstrual and obstetric history, as well as usually as a section on vaccinations and preventive care. This section is followed by a section on social history, which includes occupation, habits, healthy or risky behaviors, and the like, and then a section on family history, which includes any illnesses that may run in the family, especially cancer, heart disease, and so forth. Following this, the history and physical contains a complete review of systems, a detailed organ system by organ system review made to elucidate any important symptoms which may not have come to light through other means. The history and physical then contains a section describing the findings on physical examination, once again with a substructure following a highly structured convention. Following this information is included ancillary data such as laboratory test results, chest x-ray and other reports, and so forth. Once these things are recorded in the history and physical, data are complete and new sections that contain the clinician's assessment and plan follow. It may be worth noting that this order of information is analogous to or somewhat parallels the structure of scientific papers and scientific argument. The statement of the problem precedes the description of the methods and findings, and these sections precede the interpretation of these findings and the author's conclusions. Knowing this structure, we can return to the story presented earlier of a man with swelling in his ankles. But now that we understand the differences, we can highlight key elements of the story, indicating the symptoms reported by the patient, which are colored in red here, and those elements of the story which are signs observed by the clinician, colored in blue. Having selected these key elements, the next task in the clinical process is to reorganize the information into a conventional format. In this slide, we have given this initial structure to the data by simply taking those elements selected in the previous process and placing them in the correct order. Symptoms are organized in the history. Physical exam findings are organized with the physical. In doing so, we have taken the first step in processing the information to make sense out of it. The next step in analyzing the findings is to look for patterns and meaning in this data. In fact, of course, the culture of biomedicine includes more than just professional culture of nurses, physicians, and other health professionals. Modern healthcare settings also include the relatively distinct cultures of management, business, IT, and so forth. We can get some sense that differences exist between these interacting cultures from their language. For example, consider the words used to refer to the individuals that these groups serve. From the business point of view, they are customers. From the IT point of view, they are users. For the librarian, they're patrons. Counselors and therapists may call them clients, while most doctors and many nurses refer to them as patients. Each of these terms may be used for the same individual when interacting with different parts of the healthcare system, and these terms imply differences in underlying assumptions about their relationship. One way to help us understand how clinicians organize and reduce clinical information to make sense out of it is to use this hierarchy of clinical data described by David Evidence and Cindy Gadd. In this hierarchy, information is aggregated into higher and higher level groupings as we move from bottom to top. Starting at the bottom is what has been called the empirium, which essentially includes all of the available information at the time the patient was assessed, including information about the patient, information about the staff, and information about the clinical setting. Most often, a lot of this information is not relevant, but depending on the context, it may be. For example, the level of lighting in the room is usually not mentioned. But when one encounters a patient lying down at an exam table in a closed room with the lights off, this suggests to the clinician certain conditions that cause a person to avoid light, such as migraine or meningitis. So although most of the information in the empirium will be ignored, a subset of this information must be taken into account to understand the patient and the problem. We call this information observations, the next level up in the hierarchy. Observations are everything that we noticed and took note of by recording a complete history and physical. This includes most of the signs and symptoms which are part of the current problem, as well as many pieces of information which are collected in a standard fashion from most patients, such as blood pressure and pulse. Moving further up the hierarchy, a subset of these observations will be selected by the clinician on the basis of their relevance to the patient's care for the current active problems. We refer to these as findings. You can get a sense for the difference by comparing what a clinician has recorded in a comprehensive history and physical to the story that same clinician tells a colleague when informing him or her about the patient. A comprehensive history and physical contains all the observations. The story told to the colleague will likely contain only the findings. The relevant findings are highly context-dependent. What is relevant to a psychiatrist may be less important to an orthopedist. What is relevant in a primary care setting may be less important in the emergency department. So it is not entirely predictable which of the available observations will be considered to be findings, except by knowing the context. The next useful analytic step is accomplished by employing the next level in the hierarchy, facets. By facets, we mean groups of findings which are related by the underlying pathophysiology or disordered biologic process. For example, in a serious infection, the body will be stimulated to warm itself above the normal temperature. To raise the body temperature to a new level, a person will undergo uncontrollable shaking chills, called a rigor. Once these uncontrollable shaking chills have raised the body temperature to a higher level, the person may experience a feverish feeling and may notice that their skin is hot. Later, when the body resets its temperature set point, perhaps through the benefit of aspirin or another medication, the body will attempt to cool itself, and to do this, the skin will become flushed and sweaty. Therefore, shaking chills, high fever, and sweats are connected by a common pathophysiologic process. Clinicians would therefore group these together because they mean the same thing. Evans and Gadd call this a facet. Not all findings can be grouped with other findings, but by grouping some of them, we reduce the total amount of information and make it more manageable while giving it some meaning. A still higher level of organization is what we call a syndrome. This is often a grouping of findings and facets. For example, fever, chills, and sweats, taken together with the report of cough and sputum production, as well as pain on one side of the chest that is worse with coughing and breathing, and abnormal findings on that side of the chest when listening with a stethoscope. All these together suggest the syndrome that we call pneumonia. A syndrome is a constellation of findings which tend to occur together, usually because of mechanistic or pathophysiologic connections. It is important to understand the difference between a syndrome and a disease. We know from the findings already described that we should be thinking about pneumonia. That is a syndrome. If we further determine which kind of pneumonia this is, for example, streptococcal pneumonia, now we know the disease. The key here is that many diseases can produce the same syndrome. Many different germs can cause pneumonia syndrome, which produce the same symptoms in the patient. Many kinds of heart damage can cause the heart failure syndrome, which, for the patient, results in pretty much the same symptoms. So, a disease is a more precise statement than syndrome, which understands not only what findings are present, but also what the cause is. Finally, at the top of this hierarchy is what Evans and Gadd call a global complex. This refers to combination of syndromes or diseases that tend to occur together in the same patient. An unfortunately all too common example is portal hypertension from alcoholic cirrhosis. When clinicians use the phrase portal hypertension from alcoholic cirrhosis, they generally understand one another to mean a whole host of syndromes are present, affecting many different organ systems and causing many different symptoms, but all connected to one underlying pathophysiologic process. If one pays attention to clinical discourse, one will find many examples of communications about patients at varying levels of this hierarchy, indicating varying degrees of uncertainty or certainty about what is wrong. This slide depicts how this hierarchy might work for the man we talked about earlier who had swelling in his ankles. Starting at the bottom, we have the so-called empirium, all the observations that might have been made, which are too numerous to mention here. In the second level from the bottom, we have the observations, those things we took note of and noted, his history of weight gain, the tight-fitting pants, his high blood pressure, and so forth. If we go up another level to findings, we can select a subset of those observations that seem to be key to understanding his problem. Weight gain, shortness of breath when he exerts himself, called dyspnea on exertion or DOE, a history of high blood pressure, etc. Going up still another level to facets, we can group some of these. For example, weight gain seems to go together with the edema if he has been retaining fluid. The high blood pressure goes together with that abnormal heart sound called an S4, which occurs in patients with high blood pressure. We might try to connect his pale skin with his rapid pulse, but there is a danger in drawing the conclusion that two things are connected when they are not. So we might want to leave those separate for now until we know more about the patient. Next. We can try to group these findings and facets into syndromes. For example, his pale skin suggests that he might be anemic, so we might want to test for that. His high blood pressure, history, weight gain, and shortness of breath when he exerts himself, as well as swelling of the ankles, all suggest that he may have heart failure. So we might group these together as the syndrome of heart failure. At the next level, we consider diseases. With reference to his heart failure, it could be a heart failure that results from high blood pressure, or heart failure from alcoholism, or heart failure from coronary artery disease and heart attacks, or perhaps from some toxin. So this leads us to what clinicians call a differential diagnosis. At this stage, we have begun to make sense out of these symptoms and signs, reducing the data by organizing it into meaningful groupings. This can give us enough of a sense of what's going on to begin treatment and diagnostic testing. Though note that when we begin these treatments and ordering these tests before we really know the diagnosis, which creates a bit of a problem if you have to assign a code before you know the true diagnosis. More on this later. Based on the process we have just gone through, giving structure to the data with the history and physical format, analyzing that data by organizing it into meaningful groups, we can create what we call a problem list, depicted here in the left column. A problem list is essentially a to-do list for patient care. It contains all of the things which the clinician must do something about to help the patient. In some cases, these will be expressed as diseases, when a specific disease is known. In other cases, they may be expressed as syndromes, when the exact cause of the syndrome is unknown. In still other cases, they may be expressed as symptoms or problems because we don't know enough to say any more than the patient is, for example, short of breath. Of course, the way that the problem list's items are expressed will evolve over time as more information becomes available. This means that the problem list which is created when we first see the patient is going to be different from the problem list which exists after examination and treatment and time. On this slide, we show how the symptoms and signs of the patient listed in the left column form the basis for a problem list. In the right column, we show some rules for creating problem lists. First, we should group related items that don't need to be listed separately if they are part of the same process, but we should keep them separate if we're not sure. Second, we should include items that need attention or action, but not items that do not, because they clutter the page and the mind. Should the tonsillectomy be recorded in the problem list? The fact that a patient is a male? That they smoke? It all depends. Third, we should express each problem at the level at which we understand it and no more. To do otherwise can lead to the diagnostic error of premature closure, where we stop pursuing the cause before we really understand it. And this can lead sometimes to inappropriate diagnosis and treatment. Once codified into the medical record, there are problems with the persistence of data and with the precision of the coding as the condition and our understanding of it evolve.